It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. In school, in his native Bluefield, little John Nash liked bigger numbers than his teachers were using.
I did have a taste for numbers. In school, I liked to work with larger numbers than we were taught to use. Five digits rather than two or three.
Nash discusses his beautiful mind coming up on this West Virginia morning. The West Virginia University Solar Decathlon team is waking up this morning in California, beginning its preparations for the 2013 Solar Decathlon competition. WVU is one of a handful of schools from around the world that's competing. Beneduccio has more.
The team is taking 29 people, including students, to spend several weeks competing in this event. The teams will be taking on Herculean tasks, so to speak, by building a home in a week, complete with several energy-saving amenities, before being judged on its contents. WVU is one of 20 teams from around the world that's competing in Irvine, California. WVU's team is building a home in the style of a rustic log cabin that utilizes energy-efficient technologies. Brandon Belenka is the student project leader.
For everybody who's worked on this over the last 2 years, it's just for all of it to finally come full circle, for it to come from, you know, just being on a piece of paper and now it's like standing in front of you. It was a powerful moment.
The event is going to play out more like a marathon. The team has a ticking clock to get the house up before competition starts. Then the team must allow the public to tour the home. Finally, competition will begin. The team's house must go through a series of rigorous tests.
You know, how well do your appliances work? They're going to wash and dry clothes and see if you're able to clean them. Run the dishwasher. They're going to check your lighting. They're going to check out for two of the nights we have to serve dinner.
The menu is West Virginia-inspired cuisine, by the way. So this whole experience sounds like a challenge, right? Well, try this. WVU is the only school in the competition using another school, in fact, an international school, to help them along the way. That's the University of Rome Tor Vergata. That school helped with the architectural design of the house. Andrea Argabright, another team member, says the relationship's been great, and one of that school's students is heading to Irvine, too.
I mean, obviously it's a little bit difficult because there is such a big time difference and you can't just, you know, drive an hour, go see them, work things out, have a meeting. But I think it's given us a lot of opportunity to, like, expand our thinking and have different designs because it is another culture. And, I mean, there's great architecture around Europe. So just to have that available to us was nice.
Belenka stresses this trip really isn't the end of a journey that's taken more than a year. It's the beginning of the competition, the beginning of a new opportunity. So while on this journey, what surprised him the most?
It happened. It literally happened, and it's there, and we're going to be taking it to California. We're going to rebuild it, and we're going to show it off and you know, really show what the university is capable of, what the students are capable of. So it's a pretty incredible feat.
WVU is already thinking ahead to the 2015 competition, planning their next design. After this competition, the team's log cabin will be used for nanotechnology research at WVU. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Beneduccio in Morgantown.
The West Virginia Small Business Development Center showed a crowd of entrepreneurs and business owners how technology can help tackle small business needs. Clark Davis has the story.
In the third of five planned workshops throughout the state, the West Virginia Small Business Development Center walked entrepreneurs through the process of beginning their own business. This workshop focused on the necessity of technology to make it in today's market. Justin Gall is the Technology Commercialization Manager for the center.
An SBC business coach works to serve as a connector, so we help the entrepreneurs in West Virginia find resources they can use to move their businesses or their ideas forward. We also serve as a coach and help them through the leadership and strategy issues of their business, and also on a personal level, you know, is business right for me?
Gall says the goal is to help reduce the risk that the entrepreneurs are taking and find the best ways to begin tackling the tasks of starting a business. Last week's session focused on everything from the early stages of development justification for innovation, how to analyze the market for the product, and how to get to the level they want to attain. Gall says the process can look like a mountain to climb at the beginning.
It sometimes appears daunting to get in and try to commercialize some new product or technology. And what we do is help walk them through that visionary process that sometimes is negated in the very beginning. Someone has a great idea and they bring that prototype into the office and they're ready to move forward from that point. And sometimes that's not the best thing because they need to back up and ask those key questions.
Price Haynes of Huntington attended the conference with the idea of using college logos on different kinds of merchandise. He says it definitely seems like a larger undertaking.
I think right now we're opening a can of worms, if you will. You look at the business model and maybe there are five steps or however many steps there are to it. Well, each step contains 30 more steps and so on and so forth. So there are a lot of angles and things to consider along each step of the way.
Tom Minnick is the Director of Special Projects and Business Development with the Robert C. Byrd Institute at Huntington. RCBI is a nonprofit training service that provides small businesses access to what they need to continue developing their business. The Institute serves as a co-sponsor of the workshops. He says the workshops are essential because many people that come to them with ideas aren't prepared.
There's people out there that did not do their homework, did not do the searches. They have an idea, but the sister's already on the street, and then some people come in with a real realistic idea, but they don't know how to get to the next level with it. It's still in their head, not reality.
Minnick says they hope to give workshop participants the information needed to take the next step.
They'll take that and then come back to RCBI. We'll put them with a partner, them up with an engineer. We'll try to see if we can get them a grant to take them to the next level. We try to do then prototyping for them and any assistance we can go partnering with other companies in our 21st century manufacturing network of 500 plus companies.
Previous workshops were held in Bridgeport and Charleston, and the next two will be held in the Eastern Panhandle and once again in Bridgeport. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
This is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:37. Some dense fog this morning, becoming sunny and pleasant today with temperatures in the 60s and 70s. Clear overnight, dense fog forming again after midnight, overnight lows in the 40s. Dense fog tomorrow morning, followed by mostly sunny skies with temperatures in the 60s and 70s on Tuesday. On Thursday, West Virginia Public Radio will premiere the fourth season of Inspiring West Virginians, a program that profiles West Virginians who are leaders in the sciences and business. In a preview this morning, we hear from a man who has been called a mathematical genius and an economic visionary. Besides Pearl Buck, he's the only other person from West Virginia who's won a Nobel Prize. Gene Snedeker traveled to Princeton, New Jersey, to meet Bluefield native John Nash.
This is my high school in Bluefield. It's a class reunion.
That's your 50th high school class reunion.
Yes. I'm in the corner here.
Yeah, how wonderful.
The man in the corner is John Forbes Nash Jr., one of the greatest mathematicians of the 20th century.
This is a picture of the high school building.
We're in his office on the ninth floor of Fine Hall, the math building at Princeton University, a place some people call the mathematical center of the universe. What is this?
An aerial picture of Bluefield. This is the nearby mountain. It's called East River Mountain.
It almost looks like the sea pouring over into Bluefield, West Virginia, doesn't it? One whole bookshelf in Nash's office is lined with photos of Bluefield, West Virginia. Now 84, John Nash left the state more than 60 years ago. But clearly, it's still important to him. Over his lifetime, John Nash has sought out and solved some of mathematics' most difficult problems. And he solved them in ways that amazed other mathematicians, but not without great trials to overcome. In 2001, Ron Howard made a film about Nash called A Beautiful Mind, starring Russell Crowe. It won the Oscar for Best Picture and many other awards. The film and the book on which the film is based tell the story of Nash's meteoric rise in the mathematical world, his early career teaching at MIT, his sudden descent into severe mental illness, and ultimately his recovery from that illness. But John Nash's story begins in Bluefield, West Virginia, in Mercer County.
My mother had been born there, and she had sisters. I had only one sibling, my sister. It's a special relationship.
Martha Nash Legg remembers Bluefield as a nice place to grow up.
I loved the mountains. There was plenty of business going on. We had a wonderful neighborhood. Children played.
Tell me what John was like then.
Well, I guess today we'd call him nerdy. His friends were ones who also were bright. He liked science fiction. He was musical. Or he is musical to the extent that he can whistle Bach.
I was quite aware that I wasn't so close to other people that were related to me. I guess I'm a little like an Asperger's type.
So you found it difficult to make friends?
Well, not entirely difficult, but I didn't have very strong friendship relations generally. I wasn't just a buddy of the group.
Even as a little boy, Johnny was drawn to mathematics.
I did have a taste for numbers. In school, I liked to work with larger numbers than we were taught to use, five digits rather than two or three.
You talk about a book that you read that really influenced you.
Men of Mathematics by E.T. Bell. He's an American. But the book was somehow inspiring, the way it talked about the mathematical discoveries and what these people had done.
Nash was particularly intrigued by the 17th century French mathematician Pierre de Fermat. As a 14-year-old, John succeeded in proving Fermat's theorem. After high school, John Nash went to Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh. In 3 years, he earned both a bachelor's and master's degree in mathematics. One of his teachers recognized he was a mathematical genius and encouraged him to go to Princeton University for a PhD. At Princeton, Nash's dissertation was in a field called game theory, at the time a relatively new concept that explains human behavior. His main contribution to game theory, which later became known as the Nash equilibrium, has been used in a wide variety of fields, from economics to foreign policy to information technology, even evolutionary biology. Nash also solved a few very, very difficult problems in pure mathematics, and he did it in a way that still inspires young mathematicians, including Dayan Slabchev, Associate Professor of Mathematics at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
Nash's papers, they are very brief and have many ideas in them. Not just one idea that solves everything, but at every step there is a new idea, and yet there is the whole picture of how everything fits together. So that is the beauty of the thing. So if you speak about the beautiful mind, then it must be the mind which is able to store so many new ideas together at the same time must be in some way beautiful.
But at the height of this brilliant young mathematician's career, John Nash developed paranoid schizophrenia, a severe mental illness. For more than 25 years, he had all sorts of delusions about who he was, who other people were, and messages he was receiving. He wandered the campus of Princeton University, writing on blackboards and whistling Bach to himself. He became known as the Phantom of Fine Hall. And then, without medication, he started to get better.
The return to sanity was a gradual process, but I did gradually rejected listening to voices. I was able to put it aside after a while.
One morning in 1994, a few years after John Nash returned to what he calls rational thinking, an amazing thing happened, as John's sister, Martha Nash Legg, remembers.
I had gotten up, and I was in the bathroom getting ready to go out with my dog. And the radio was on in the bedroom there. And I heard them say something about the Nobel Prize Award in economics. And I thought they said John Nash and game theory. I had no idea game theory had anything to do with economics. That's how much I knew about it. And brought tears to my eyes thinking how much my parents would have loved to have heard that.
After years of illness and unemployment, the Nobel Prize literally changed John Nash's life. Princeton University appointed him a senior research mathematician,
Other awards and honors followed. The man who was almost forgotten was invited to lecture at universities throughout the world. And today, he continues to tackle difficult problems in mathematics and economics.
Now, most people, of course, are retired by your age, but you're still working.
True, yes, yes. It's not unusual to work to 70, maybe 75, but now I'm 84. I could go to 90.
And he just may well do that. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jean Snediger.
Tune in for the full feature on John Nash and others, profiled on Inspiring West Virginians, Thursday evening at 9, right here on West Virginia Public Radio. It's officially autumn. The season brings visions of the brilliant foliage. West Virginia Public Radio's music host and producer, Jim Lang, reflects on the symphony of sound fall brings, both man-made and natural.
Fall is here without a doubt. And with it comes my favorite autumnal sounds, like Brian Eno. Or Gustav Mahler. But there is one sound that profoundly makes me realize that summer is over. Yes, the cicada announces the season's change like no other. I wanted to know more about cicadas and their cacophonous songs. I spoke with entomologist Dr. Tracy Leskey. So, what exactly are cicadas?
Well, you know, cicadas are insects that belong to what we call the order Hemiptera, which is the order of insects to which the true bugs belong. Not all insects are bugs, but there are a group of insects that are literally referred to by entomologists as bugs, and cicadas are one of those.
Are they special in any kind of way?
Oh, yeah. Cicadas are really interesting. Cicadas are conspicuously known because of their interesting developmental attributes. And one of these, in the case of our annual or dog day cicadas, is their very conspicuous emergence during the later part of the summer. The cicadas actually have a really interesting life history, sort of how they grow up, in that the juvenile stage of adult cicadas, the nymphs, live in the soil. But what's interesting is those nymphs that are in the soil, they actually spend 2 to 5 years in the soil completing their development. So, you know, some of those dog day cicadas that you see emerging literally are the same age as some of our kindergartners going to school this year.
And how do they make that sound?
Well, that's the adult stage. And so in this case, it's the males that make the sound. The females do not make those sounds. The males have what we would call almost a pair of built-in drums in their abdomen, and we refer to these as timbals. And these timbals produce the sound based on this very tiny ribbed membrane that is there on their abdomen, and then it's powered by muscle contraction. So those muscles contract and relax, and as they do that, it creates a sound. And the other piece that's interesting is the male's abdomen is nearly hollow, and so this allows the sound to be amplified.
These are males calling to females, and they're just sort of, I mean, why are they doing this is what I'm going to say.
So, yeah, the males are doing this literally to find a mate. They are trying to attract females to their location. So, you know, it may sound like a bit of a cacophony to us, but, you know, it's sweet music to a female cicada.
So, while we hear this, female cicadas might be hearing this.
Bubbles, bangles, hear how they jing-jing-a-ling-a. Bubbles, bangles, bright, shiny beads.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jim Lang in Charleston.
Her heart will sing, sing a linger, wearing bubbles.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can listen to and read news stories on our website, wvpubcast.org. You can subscribe to the podcast of this program while you're there. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Beneduccio. Our director is Bob Powell. I'm Beth Voorhees.